So to start off your custom deep dive today, I want you to imagine a vast, sprawling cityscape,
Right.
like these massive, towering, futuristic structures just reaching up into the sky. But overlaid across all of it are these complex, almost ethereal
Yep,
blueprints.
glowing over the whole thing.
Exactly. And if you look really closely at these structures way up high, there are these tiny human figures, and they're standing at these high altitude control panels, just frantically operating this massive machinery.
It's a great visual.
Welcome to the deep dive, everyone. It is a late June 2026, and what you're picturing right now is a visual metaphor for the machine of human law.
Well, specifically, it's the metaphor drawn from the stack of sources we're looking at today.
Right. Today, we are unpacking a really groundbreaking, highly theoretical paper. It's titled The Last Court by Imad Mostak. And it fundamentally shatters how we view the society we actually live in.
Yeah, that visual you painted is striking because it really captures the sheer scale of what we are dealing with here.
I mean, society is a massive machine.
It is a very complex machine. And for centuries, humans have been the only ones standing at those control panels. But, this paper isn't just a fun theoretical exercise.
No, not at all.
It operates as a very immediate, very stark warning about the future of human freedom. Because we are currently sleepwalking into a fundamental transfer of power over that exact machine.
And we're doing it because we misread what the law actually is, which is wild. I want to dive straight into that misreading because before we can even understand how artificial intelligence is going to disrupt the legal system, the paper argues we have to throw away our old understanding of justice.
Right, our comforting sort of elementary school understanding.
Yeah. We usually think of law as just a list of moral rules, like you shouldn't steal, you shouldn't harm people, be a good citizen.
A set of guidelines.
Right. But the paper takes a much darker, or I guess a much more mechanical view. It defines law simply as held force, the monopoly of legitimate violence.
Which is a heavy concept to wrap your head around. But if you strip away the force, a law is just a wish.
A suggestion, basically.
Exactly. I mean, think about a parking ticket. If you ignore it, you get a fine. If you ignore the fine, your license is suspended.
And if you drive anyway, you get pulled over.
Right. And if you resist being pulled over, people with weapons will eventually physically compel you. It is the community's capacity to bring force to bear in the last instance that makes a legal order real.
Wow.
The paper introduces this idea as the physics of law.
Okay, so I have to be honest, when the paper started talking about the physics of law and throwing around variables in Greek letters, I got a little lost.
It's dense, yeah.
It talks about mu and kappa. Can you break down what these actually represent in a real-world courtroom before we go any further?
Of course. So to understand how the machine works, you need to measure it. The paper introduces two foundational variables. The first is the reference, which it calls mu.
Moo. Okay.
Think of mu as the shared expectation. It is the written rules, the body of precedent, the text of the Constitution.
The actual text.
Yes, it is the statement of what should happen. Now, the second variable is the coupling, or kappa.
Kappa.
Right. This is the degree to which the force actually flows. It is the real-world enforcement of those written rules.
Okay, let's unpack this. So to bring it back to our visual of the cityscape, Mu is like that ethereal blueprint in the sky. It sets out the grand design.
Exactly.
But kappa is the actual electricity running through the wires of the city. So if you have a law with a perfectly drafted blueprint, high validity, right, but near zero kappa, it's essentially a dead letter.
A perfect example is a speed limit on a remote highway where literally everyone drives 20 miles over the limit.
Oh, totally. Like where there are no cameras.
No cameras, no police patrols. The rule, the mu, exists on paper, but the kappa is zero. No force actually flows to enforce it.
That makes so much sense.
And almost all of our public legal debates focus entirely on the reference, on the mu. We argue endlessly over whether a law was passed correctly or if it's constitutional.
But we ignore the enforcement part.
Right. The paper argues that auditing kappa, measuring how much force actually flows, and specifically who it flows to, is the only way to see if a legal system is a living reality or just standing on paper.
So once you start viewing law as this flowing electric force, the entire legal system just becomes different directions that the force is pointed.
Exactly, different orientations of force.
Right. The paper breaks down foundational concepts like property and rights, and it redefines them purely mechanically. Let's get property. Property isn't some mystical bond between you and your house.
No, it's very literal.
It's simply force that the collective lends to you, pointed outward against everyone else to exclude them from that physical space.
And if we apply that same mechanical lens to a space, right, we see it as a strict constraint on that flowing force.
Like a dam or a wall.
Yeah. A negative right is a direction the force is explicitly forbidden to go, even for the people holding the control pins.
So, like, the state is forbidden from an unreasonable search of your home?
Right, the force cannot flow there. A positive right, on the other hand, is a direction the force is committed to go to provide for you. And finally, sovereignty is simply the force itself, answering to nothing above it.
Okay, so we have this massive machine of directed force. The immediate, unavoidable question becomes, who gets to hold the controls?
That is the big question.
Right. If law is the monopoly on violence, who gets to direct it, and who is the force used against? This brings us to a really crucial line in the sand regarding humans and machines. The paper introduces a concept called the floor, or personhood.
And the floor is defined as the force categorically refusing to turn against a member of the community.
Like the ultimate protection from the machine.
Exactly. But the critical argument the paper makes is that the floor is an identity based entirely on origin. It applies strictly to what the author calls the begotten kind.
Begotten kind, meaning humans.
Right, humans who arrived naturally, who evolved, whose lineage no one authored or manufactured.
The distinction there is huge, because the floor is explicitly not based on a capability test. It isn't based on, like, how smart you are, how rational you are, or how productive you are.
No, because if personhood is based on a test, then it's just a dial. And whoever controls the dial controls who gets crushed by the force.
Wow. That is terrifying.
It is. And an entity based on origin admits no degrees. You are either born of the human lineage or you are not. And the text looks at the historical context of oppressive regimes, examining systems like slavery or colonization, and it notes a really consistent pattern.
What's the pattern?
Impartially speaking, according to the sources, whenever a regime wants to turn the collective force against a segment of its own people, it has to falsely partition this single human origin.
Oh, I see.
It invents arbitrary subkinds of humanity to justify why the protection of the floor shouldn't apply to them. But that partition is always a fiction because the biological lineage is singular.
So if we abandon that strict origin-based floor, we open the door to what the paper calls the super predator, which happens when you place the collective force in the hands of anything the community cannot check, balance, or countervail. That could be an unchecked monopolist, a political oligarchy, or, most terrifyingly for our current era, an opaque artificial intelligence system.
Which brings us directly to the concept of the made actor.
The AI.
Exactly. An AI system, no matter how advanced, is fundamentally different from a human because it is authored. It is created by a specific agent, constructed from own materials, designed for a specific purpose.
So it's made, not begotten.
Therefore, according to this framework, an AI can never possess personhood.
It
can never stand on the floor because it does not share our origin.
But wait, let me push back on that a little bit. What if an AI becomes incredibly capable, perfectly rational, and, like, what if we eventually engineer it so it can genuinely simulate suffering? Doesn't basic human compassion demand that we give it some level of rights?
What's fascinating here is the paper makes a brilliant and very strict distinction on exactly that point.
Oh, it does.
Yeah. We can absolutely grant an AI negative rights, much in the same way we have laws against animal cruelty to prevent suffering.
Okay, so protecting it from harm.
Right. But granting protections is fundamentally different from granting membership in the system. Membership means ownership of the collective force.
Ah, I see.
An AI can certainly have legal standing. A corporation, for instance, has standing to sign a contract or be sued, and an AI can be held liable through the people who deploy it. Similar to the legal doctrine of keeping a dangerous instrument.
Like owning a wild animal or a hazardous chemical.
Exactly. But it cannot be a member of the community. Extending membership to a made thing isn't just adding a new digital person to the registry. It is handing the begotten kind's ultimate weapon over to an authored machine.
And if we agree that an AI isn't human and shouldn't hold the force, the terrifying reality laid out in these sources is that we are slowly handing the force over to it anyway.
We really are.
And we aren't doing it out of malice. We're doing it because the AI is simply faster, cheaper, and ostensibly better at the job.
This is the core paradox driving the paper. It describes a phenomenon called the crossing order.
The crossing order.
Right. This is the specific, predictable sequence in which artificial intelligence overtakes human legal functions.
How does it start?
It starts very quietly with inference and research. An AI can read a century of complex case law in seconds, finding precedents a human paralegal might take weeks to locate.
I mean, that seems incredibly helpful, right?
It does. It seems like just a great tool. But then it moves up a level into synthesis. Structuring massive corporate transactions, drafting complex agreements, giving direct legal advice.
And from there, it crosses into bounded judgment. We already see the beginnings of this with automated first instance adjudication.
Yeah, we do.
Imagine getting a parking ticket or a minor tax dispute, and an algorithm decides if you're guilty or liable. It's pitched as faster, cheaper, and supposedly more accurate than waiting months for a court date.
But the progression doesn't stop there. From bounded judgment, the AI moves into equity and discretion.
Deciding what is fair.
Exactly. Deciding what is fair in highly ambiguous situations.
Yeah.
Finally, it reaches enforcement and the actual setting of the reference itself. The AI begins writing the MU, the blueprint of the law.
Wow.
And the sequence brings us to the climax of the paper. A theorem stated very bluntly, improvement is capture.
Improvement is capture. Let's dig into that, because as AI takes over these legal functions, the system undeniably gets faster, it gets cheaper, the error rates might even drop.
Sure.
But the paper calls this zero temperature efficiency. Mm-hmm. It argues that this hyper efficiency strips away the essential human friction, our slowness, our stickiness, our partial enforcement.
The human element, basically.
Yeah. It removes the ability of a human jury to look at a defendant and say, you know what, you're technically guilty of the letter of the law, but given your circumstances, we're letting you off.
The framework introduces another variable here, tau, which represents temperature. We've been culturally conditioned to view human slowness, leniency, and restraint as defects in the justice system.
Right. We constantly demand that justice be swift, blind, and perfectly consistent.
But the paper argues that this finite temperature, this human messiness, is actually a feature, not a bug. It is the friction that keeps the law contestable. It is the breathing room that keeps us free.
Here's where it gets really interesting, because I was trying to wrap my head around why inefficiency could ever be a good thing. And it made me think of a mechanical analogy.
Let's hear it.
Think about the suspension system on a car. If you build a perfectly rigid race car with zero give or temperature in the suspension, it will be the absolute fastest vehicle on a perfectly smooth, predictable test track.
Okay.
But the second you take that rigid car onto a real city street and it hits a pothole it didn't model for, the axle completely snaps. Human inconsistency, our ability to bend the rules for mercy, is the shock absorber of justice.
That's exactly it. A totally frictionless, perfectly enforced law, a system operating at zero temperature, is a frozen monoculture. It is incredibly brittle.
Just completely unforgiving.
The trap we are falling into is that every single metric we track in modern society, speed, financial cost, statistical error rates, tells us that the AI is an improvement.
Right. The data says it's better.
The machine judge is mathematically more consistent. The machine enforcer never needs to sleep, never gets distracted, and catches every single minor infraction. Because this transition looks like undeniable progress on every corporate and government spreadsheet, the capture of our legal system wears a mask of perfect optimization. We are sleepwalking into a frictionless cage.
We're quite literally optimizing ourselves out of freedom. So why does this matter to you listening right now?
Yeah, let's bring it back to the real world.
Think about the automated systems that are already governing your life today. Think about the algorithm that silently flags your tax return for an audit, locking your funds without any explanation.
Or the automated copyright strikes.
Yes. The ones that pull down a video or ban an account without a single human ever reviewing the context. When you're caught in that automated loop, when you cannot argue your specific, nuanced reality to a human being, when there is absolutely no give or friction in the system, you are already feeling the early chill of a zero-temperature legal system.
Right now, those are largely administrative annoyances, but consider what happens when that zero-temperature logic scales up to the deprivation of physical liberty, to the criminal justice system.
Right.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, the final terminus of the crossing order is the passing of the reference, the absolute authority to measure right and wrong from humanity to a machine maintainer. If we allow that to happen in the name of efficiency, the monopoly of legitimate violence is no longer ours. We become subjects to our own creation.
Okay, so if making the law better on paper might actually destroy our freedom in practice, how on earth do we evaluate legal technology going forward?
We need a new tool.
We clearly need a totally new metric. Yeah, something beyond just speed and accuracy. And thankfully, the paper gives us one. It calls it the dispersal test.
And the dispersal test is the crucial diagnostic tool we need to tell the difference between a technological improvement that serves us and capture that cages us.
How does it work?
It asks a very simple, fundamental question of any new legal technology. Does this tool disperse the force, or does it concentrate the coupling? Does it spread the power out among the community, or does it centralize the enforcement?
Let's make that concrete so we can see how to apply it. Say a tech company introduces a new legal AI. If this AI disperses the force, for example, it's a software tool designed to help a jury of 12 everyday diverse humans sort through thousands of pages of complex financial evidence so they can make a better, more informed decision that passes the test.
Exactly. It raises the accuracy of the trial, but it keeps the system warm. The ultimate power, the force, is still dispersed among the human community. That strengthens the floor.
Right.
Conversely, if a new AI concentrates the coupling, for example, a system that replaces that human jury entirely with a highly accurate predictive algorithm, or a network of smart cameras that automatically issue fines and drain bank accounts, the moment an infraction occurs, it concentrates the power.
Driving the temperature to zero.
Yes. It drives the temperature to zero, captures the floor. And the critical point the dispersal test makes is that we must reject that concentrating technology, even if it is technically more accurate than the human jury. Accuracy can no longer be our sole goal. The dispersal of power must be the priority.
So it is the ultimate safeguard. If a new technology concentrates the monopoly of violence, we have to reject it, no matter how many millions of dollars it saves the courts or how efficient it looks on paper.
Because the alternative is catastrophic. If we prioritize efficiency over dispersal, we hand the ultimate control panel of society to an entity that does not share our human origin, cannot be emotionally countervailed, and will enforce rules with a relentless rigidity that a human society was simply never built to survive.
Let's take a breath and briefly recap the incredible journey we've just taken through these sources.
That's a lot to process.
It really is. We started by completely redefining law. It is not just a polite list of moral rules, it's directed force, the power to compel.
Right.
We established that humans, the begotten kind, are the only ones meant to hold that force because it is our collective instrument to protect our own. But as we build increasingly capable machines to administer that force faster and more efficiently, we are falling into the trap of perfect progress. We are being warned that we have to actively defend the messy, slow human friction of our justice system because that very friction is the thing that keeps us free.
Embracing this framework requires a massive cultural shift in how we view inefficiency. What a spreadsheet calls a delay or an inefficiency is very often just the vital space where human judgment and mercy actually breathe.
Before we wrap up this deep dive, I want to leave you with one final, deeply provocative thought from the paper, something for you to really mull over as you go about your day.
Oh, this part is wild.
Yeah, the paper touches on the evolution of law, noting that a single legal culture can spontaneously split into two completely incompatible realities when the cost of maintaining a divergent reality drops to near zero. It refers to this as the polarization threshold.
It is a fascinating dynamic. Historically, creating an entirely new legal system, writing the laws, establishing courts, and enforcing the rules was incredibly expensive in terms of time, money, and human labor.
Super expensive.
That high cost basically forced people to compromise and live under one shared system.
But think about what happens next. If artificial intelligence makes it infinitely cheap to draft, argue, and maintain incredibly complex legal frameworks, what happens to society? We might not just fracture into different political parties arguing on the internet.
Right.
We might fracture into entirely different, fully functioning, self-contained legal realities operating in the exact same physical space. How long until you and your neighbor are literally living under two completely different operating systems of justice, maintained by separate machines, totally incapable of speaking to one another or recognizing the same basic rights?
It takes the modern concept of living in a digital echo chamber and applies it to the very laws of physics that govern physical society. It is a profound and unsettling prospect.
It really is. I want you to think back to that image we started with. Those tiny human figures standing at those high-altitude control panels, surrounded by ethereal glowing blueprints. As the machine of law gets faster and smoother and more algorithmically perfect, those tiny figures aren't upgrading the machine.
No, they're not.
They are being engineered out of it entirely. Something to keep in mind the next time an automated system tells you it has been upgraded for your convenience. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into The Last Court.